Minister Israel Katz said, quote, "The state of Israel will not cease firing. We will destroy Hamas and continue fighting until the very last hostage has come home," he said. Meanwhile, the U.S. is at odds with the U.N. over whether the resolution is binding or not. Deputy U.N. spokesperson Farhan Haq said U.N. Security Council resolutions are, quote, as binding as international law. But on Monday, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., described the resolution as non-binding.
"We appreciated the willingness of members of this council to take some of our edits and improve on this resolution. Still, certain key edits were ignored, including our request to add a condemnation of Hamas. And we did not agree with everything in the resolution. For that reason, we were unfortunately not able to vote yes. However, as I've said before, we fully support some of the critical objectives in this non-binding resolution, and we believe it was important for the council to speak out and make clear that our ceasefire must, any ceasefire, must come with the release of all hostages. Indeed, as I've said before, the only path to a durable end to this conflict is the release of all hostages."
For more, we're joined by Craig McIver, international human rights lawyer who formerly served as the director of the New York Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, where he worked for more than three decades as a human rights official. He resigned in October over the UN's failure to adequately address large-scale atrocities in Palestine and in protest of Israel's assault on Gaza. Craig McIver, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you explain the significance of this UN Security Council resolution, the U.S. abstaining, and whether or not this is binding?
Well, thank you, Amy and Juan. Nice to be with you again. It is significant. You've picked the right adjective there, because this was a draft that was put forward by the non-permanent members, the elected members of the Security Council, the so-called E10. And these 10 members include representatives from around the world, including some key allies of the United States, which created, I think, a degree of political pressure that added to hopes that the resolution would not be vetoed in this case. I have to say that it follows just a few days after the council rejected a rather cynical draft that was submitted by the United States, the text of which I have said is a kind of an anti-ceasefire resolution. It didn't order a ceasefire, but effectively set out Israel's conditions for ceasing its violations of international law. And that was a real problem, because a lot of U.S. media outlets were reporting on that resolution as a ceasefire resolution when it was anything but. But yesterday's resolution was an actual ceasefire resolution, a rather weak one, which I will comment on. But it is a ceasefire resolution. It calls for a brief ceasefire, for access for humanitarian aid at scale, for lawful treatment of prisoners, including Palestinian prisoners, and for release of hostages. And it's important because, you know, we're in the midst of a genocide, and you have this nearly moribund Security Council that has failed for 6 months, that is finally succeeding at least in demanding a temporary ceasefire. Any pause will save lives, and any aid that gets in as a result during an imposed starvation will make a difference, no doubt about it. It's also important because it's a signal, again, of the very broad consensus across the global community against Israel's onslaught on Gaza, and it will be another legal tool that can help in holding perpetrators accountable after the provisional order of the World Court on Israel's genocide. But, you know, unfortunately, while it contains some hopeful, aspirational language that may lead to a lasting ceasefire, it only demands a ceasefire during the month of Ramadan, which will end in just over 2 weeks. So it is a very short pause during this genocide. And we know that one of the U.S.'s conditions for not vetoing the resolution was the deletion of the word permanent, which, of course, changes the substance of the resolution very significantly. So despite all of this talk about tensions in U.S.-Israeli relations and this rare instance of the U.S. not vetoing a resolution on Israel's behalf, the U.S. is clearly continuing to run interference on behalf of Israel at the U.N. And as you say, this is made all the more clear by the statements of the U.S. immediately after the adoption of the resolution, in which the U.S. has claimed, entirely falsely, by the way, that the ceasefire demand is conditional on the release of hostages, and secondly, that the resolution itself is non-binding. Linda Thomas-Greenfield, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., made these claims in the session of the Security Council after the adoption of the resolution. Both of these claims are completely false and have no legal grounding. The U.N. Charter and its Article 25, subsequent decisions of the International Court of Justice have made this undisputable. Security Council resolutions are binding on all member states. And this is, you know, this is black letter law in the charter that says that all members of the United Nations are bound to accept and carry out the decisions of the Security Council, as I say, subsequently affirmed by the International Court of Justice. And the claim that the ceasefire is to be conditioned on other factors like the release of hostages, this is completely false as well. This was a key central focus of the negotiations, was to make sure that these things were not conditioned one on the other, but they are separate demands of the Security Council. The United States knows this, but it is cynically distorting the record in order to, on the one hand, be able to claim that it has gone along or not blocked an international move toward a ceasefire because of pressure from domestic and international constituencies, and on the other hand, making sure that nothing really changes on the ground. It shows how the U.S., how committed the U.S. has been to undercutting the resolution even before the ink was dry. So if you look at the process, the U.S. used its power to water down the text during negotiations. It still did not vote in favor, only abstaining, and then immediately and falsely declared that it's non-binding and conditional. And in the end, I have to say, we also know that Israel is unlikely to respect any of the terms of this resolution. They've already declared that they will not do so. And they have continued all of their military offensives and genocidal assaults on the Gaza Strip since the adoption of the resolution. We also know that the United States is very unlikely to use any leverage to compel Israel to comply with the resolution. And their language now on trying to claim that it's non-binding is evidence that that is their intent. So the killing continues. Forced starvation continues, genocide continues unabated. And I think that may be the most...
Craig Mokaiba, what would be the potential actions of the United Nations to a member state that does not adhere to a binding resolution of this type? And also, what is your response to Prime Minister Netanyahu's canceling of the Israeli delegation to the U.S. over this vote?
Well, I think Israel's intentions have been made clear. If you listen to the statements of the prime minister and other cabinet ministers and military leaders, they have been clear from the beginning that they will not relent in their assault on the Gaza Strip until they've effectively accomplished the destruction of the entire Strip. And their attacks now on Rafah in particular show that, you know, the last refuge, the last piece of the Gaza Strip that hasn't been effectively destroyed is not only in their sights, but already under their bomb. So Israel never has had any intention. In fact, Israel has the world record for violating Security Council, General Assembly, Human Rights Council resolutions in the United Nations, and that that is unchanged. But this resolution can make a difference. On the one hand, there is an opportunity if Israel is in breach of the resolution to bring a resolution for enforcement under Chapter 7. Now, of course, as we've said, the United States is likely to block, to veto that resolution to prevent any enforcement, just as they will continue to block any enforcement of the decisions of the International Court of Justice regarding genocide in Palestine. In this case, because the U.S. has not vetoed it, they have, in effect, blocked action in the General Assembly under the Uniting for Peace resolution, where you could have seen some real meaningful action. You could have seen a resolution with teeth, with substance, resolution that included diplomatic, military, political, economic sanctions, not the enforcement of those sanctions, but the call for those sanctions, the deployment of a protection force, the establishment of a tribunal, the establishment of permanent mechanisms, as was the case within the United Nations during apartheid in South Africa. So there are actions that could be taken here, but the non-veto has slowed action in the General Assembly, while at the same time allowing the United States to claim that, yes, the resolution passed, but somehow it's not binding. In the end, this all comes down to the first, to the political will of member states across the organization, which already after the provisional measures of the International Court of Justice, are obliged to be taking action to rein in Israel's assault on Gaza. Few have done so, but I think there is pressure building. And then secondly, the obligation on all of us in civil society to make sure that we keep up the pressure, again, as was the case in South Africa, on our own countries to make sure that there are appropriate sanctions imposed on Israel to force it to comply and to end its genocide.
I wanted to turn to Kamal Qasem. He's a displaced Palestinian in Gaza responding to the UN Security Council vote in New York.
We hope that the decision is implemented and that it is taken seriously, because we know that Israel is stubborn and doesn't pay attention to the Security Council or any Western countries or Arab countries. And you can see what the situation is like, and the life that we are living is very, very difficult, with big massacres and genocides. Not just one genocide, and the situation is very, very hard, and we hope a ceasefire comes quickly and that the decision is implemented.
So, Craig McIver, I'm wondering if you can respond to that. And also, we're getting all sorts of reports on whether the Qatar talks are continuing those negotiations. Majid al-Ansari, a spokesperson for Qatar's foreign ministry, tells reporters negotiations on a truce are still ongoing. He rejected Israeli claims that the UN Security Council resolution calling for a ceasefire had an immediate impact on the talks. The Times of Israel said Israel has cut off Gaza truce talks in Qatar as a result. Your response and where you see this all headed at this point. I mean, even as we talk about whether Israel is going to launch a full-scale invasion, I think in the last 24 hours since the UN Security Council resolution was passed, something like 80 to 100 Palestinians were killed, most of them in Rafah.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is the challenge of enforcement. It's clear that as long as Israel's principal sponsor, I'd say it's co-belligerent, the United States of America, is not committed to reining in Israel's assaults, those assaults are going to continue, regardless of what the International Court of Justice or the Security Council or other legal mechanisms at the international level rule. They are blocked by the power of the United States in actually giving force to the decisions that they take. And unfortunately, that's what we're seeing on the ground. This is an opportunity. Right. It provides a diplomatic tool and a legal tool to press for at least this 2 week plus pause on the ground. But the clock is already ticking. Nothing has changed so far. Israel has been explicit in its rejection of the resolution, and the United States has been explicit in its position that the resolution is non-binding. And therefore, if it's non-binding, it doesn't make any sense for them to take action to try to enforce it. The key element of the U.S.'s engagement on this was to try to keep the Security Council and the United Nations generally at arm's length so that all of the center of gravity would remain with them and their diplomatic, so-called diplomatic efforts in the Middle East together with the Egyptians and the Qataris. Those talks have not borne fruit. Israel has repeatedly boycotted portions of those talks. You know, an opportunity for a 2 week pause that this resolution provides is disappearing with each passing day. And so are the opportunities to try to turn that 2 week pause, as is suggested in the resolution, into something that is more lasting. The U.S. Refused to allow the word permanent, but something more more lasting. So the pressure is going to have to come from elsewhere. It's not going to come from these key pressure points. It's going to have to come from civil society. It's going to have to come from private actors. And again, as I said before, it's going to have to come from all of us.
And Craig McIver, I wanted to ask you, there's been for years now efforts to restructure the United Nations, especially the Security Council, precisely because of the overwhelming power that the old European major powers exercise over the Security Council. Do you think that this war and the inability of the UN to act to end it will now further fuel the move to reform the UN?
Well, one can hope, Juan, I have to say. I mean, I think what this genocide has done is it has revealed the weaknesses, the political compromises, the moral failings of the United Nations and other international institutions. It has shown itself to be wholly inadequate, wholly unable to respond to a genocide being committed with Western sponsorship, with the sponsorship of powerful Western states. If this were happening in a developing country in Africa or Asia, you would see a very different response. But when the perpetrators, the co-perpetrators, are the United States, the United Kingdom, European powers, the United Nations has shown itself unable to act. You see that even in the language of the Security Council resolution. We're talking about a situation of massive war crimes, crimes against humanity, ethnic cleansing, and genocide. Because the Security Council is not set up to deal effectively with that, especially when one of its permanent members, or two of its permanent members at least, are implicated in that genocide, it's forced to dust off language about conflict as if this were a war between two states, rather than a campaign of annihilation by a heavily armed occupying power against a besieged civilian population. And that is not going to get the job done. You get a resolution that calls for a ceasefire. Even ceasefire language is not appropriate to a genocide, as the World Court itself has determined. And you get, you know, no language in here that, you know, condemns the perpetrators, that moves for accountability of perpetrators, that deals with the deployment of protection of the exposed civilian population, none of the things that would actually make a difference. And it's not just the Security Council. The political offices of the United Nations that have been set up to deal with issues like genocide, like sexual violence, like children in armed conflict, they have all failed miserably because they are politically compromised, politically controlled, unlike the independent human rights mechanisms that have done a terrific job, and the humanitarian aid workers that have done a terrific job in the UN system. These political offices and intergovernmental bodies have shown themselves to be wholly ineffective. So it certainly has increased the demand for reform. Whether there will be a willingness amongst the member states, and in particular amongst the P5, the most powerful member states of the United Nations, who sit with special rights on the Security Council in a mechanism that belongs in a Cold War museum, their lack of political will for change is what obstructs this. I still believe that demand from the ground can make a change. We saw it happen with apartheid in South Africa. We can see it happen as well if we work for it, for reforms in the UN, which I think have to happen. We need the United Nations. And on the other hand, for action against Israel's genocide.
Craig McIver, we just have 30 seconds, but the question of U.S. stopping military sales to Israel, an issue that certainly Senator Bernie Sanders, Senator Merkley, and others have called for, do you think that would make a difference?
Well, it would make a tremendous difference. As I've said before, the United States is not just tolerating this genocide. It is, in legal terms, complicit in the genocide because of its provision of military support, of weapons, of economic support, of diplomatic cover, of intelligence support, and, of the, as I said, the use of its official podiums to disseminate propaganda for a genocide on behalf of the Israelis. Any piece of that puzzle that is removed, and especially discontinuing the provision of military aid during the commission of war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide, will make a very significant change, and in fact, a much more significant change than any international resolution could hope to make.
Craig McIver, international human rights lawyer, formerly served as the director of the New York office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, where he worked for more than 30 years as a human rights official, resigning in October over the UN's failure to adequately address the Israel-Palestine conflict and Israel's assault on Gaza. Coming up, a judge in New York has decided the first of Donald Trump's four criminal trials will begin April 15th. We'll speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David K. Johnston in 20 seconds. By the drums. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. A New York judge has set April 15th, the start date for Donald Trump's hush money trial, the first of Trump's four criminal trials. On that day, Trump will become the first former U.S. president to ever face a criminal trial. He's accused of falsifying business records in violation of New York law to cover up hush money payments made to adult film star Stormy Daniels. Trump was in court Monday when the judge rejected requests to delay the trial. The judge directly criticized Trump's legal team for alleging prosecutors had improperly withheld documents from them. Meanwhile, in a separate case, a New York State appeals court has reduced Trump's bond to $175 million, down from over $450 million, to cover a civil fraud judgment. The court also gave Trump 10 more days to pay. If Trump doesn't post the bond, New York Attorney General Letitia James could begin seizing some of his properties. To talk more about this and more, we are joined by David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, co-founder of DC Report, has covered Donald Trump since the 80s. His books include The Big Cheat, How Donald Trump Fleeced America and Enriched Himself and His Family. His latest piece for The New Republic is Today is the Day That 50 Years of Grifting Finally Comes to an End. So start off talking about the significance of this reduction of money he has to pay. Do you think he's going to post it in the next 10 days? And what exactly it means, David?
Well, it is not unusual for courts to lower the size of a bond from the entire amount owed to some lesser amount. There have been a number of cases of this, and it's discretionary on the part of the courts. The bond is not intended to be punitive. It is to guarantee payment. And Trump has other assets. So I think that was a reasonable decision of this court, much as it's upset many people who are critical of Donald. The appeal will probably not take all that long, a matter of months. And having read carefully Judge Ngoren's decision, I'm not a lawyer. I'm a professor of law, but not a lawyer. And many lawyers don't see any significant grounds for appeal. The best Trump can hope for is that the roughly $350 million base award, the bond is for half of that, might be shaved back a bit, but that's about all Trump can hope for.
And David, when he was asked how he would put up now the $175 million bond in his fraud case, Trump said in a news conference Monday, quote, "I don't need to borrow money. I have a lot of money." Your response to that?
Well, this goes right to the heart of how there is no sense of objective truth or facts in Donald's world. If Donald says something, that means it's so. And if you disagree, well, you know what, Juan? Fake news. His lawyers told the court that he couldn't possibly get a bond for $454 million. He couldn't do more than $100 million at most. And then he turns around and says, "I have $500 million in cash." Donald just makes this stuff up. And he's done it his entire life. He's done it for the 35 years that I've known him. He just makes it up. Now, my guess is that he is going to borrow this money somehow. He has another bond for $83 million from a Swiss insurer, Chubb, in the E. Jean Carroll second defamation case. And in this case, he's been meeting with at least once Jeffrey Yass, a guy who's worth about $25 billion and who owns 7% of ByteDance, the parent of TikTok. As president, Donald issued an executive order banning TikTok. A court threw that out because he doesn't have the authority to do that. He said it was a national security threat. Now he's saying we need TikTok. How interesting. He makes friends with the guy who has his fortune tied up in TikTok, and suddenly he's in favor of TikTok.
We also have recently heard that Steve Mnuchin, one of his cabinet members, Trump's old cabinet members, is trying to put together a team to buy ByteDance. Is that right? So you have billionaires owning X, right? Elon Musk, right wing,
yes.
Also owning TikTok.
Yes. What you're seeing in America because of a series of Supreme Court decisions, the most important of which was Citizens United, is the conversion of American democracy into a cash register business. Whoever has the most money can buy the government policies they want. and there's a desperate need to change this. Steve Mnuchin was Trump's Treasury Secretary, became very wealthy by taking over a failed savings and loan and then enforcing the most trivial rules to force people out of their houses so he could get the value of their houses. As Treasury Secretary, he used government money so that he could fly in a comfort jet to see a celestial event. I mean, these are people who have no regard, Amy, for the public interest. They have no sense of sacrifice. They just look at government and go, wow, how rich can I get off of manipulating the government?
And David, your take on the significance of the most likely first trial now, criminal trial, being on the hush money case in New York?
Well, Judge Juan Marchand has made it very clear that he's fed up with and tired of the game playing by Trump's lawyers. They literally put themselves in the position of someone who murders their parents and then pleads for mercy because they're an orphan. They caused they were the ones who chose to wait to the last minute to seek certain documents, not from the state prosecutors, by the way, but from federal prosecutors. The case against Donald Trump in this matter is extraordinarily strong, in large part because Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's fixer and lawyer at the time, went to prison for these exact same events. But when Trump is convicted, and I think that's extraordinarily likely, he will appeal because there are 34 misdemeanor charges, which are then put together under a federal charge, not a state charge, that Trump was trying to subvert the 2020 election or the 2016 election by paying off the porn star Stormy Daniels. Trump will no doubt go to court after the trial and say, well, that's not fair. You can't do that. Because, of course, anything where law enforcement or aggrieved parties come after Trump isn't fair because Donald is special. He's above the rules. In fact, he tells his audiences he is their savior.
I wanted to go to Donald Trump leaving the courthouse on Monday.
This is all about election interference. This is all Biden-run things, meaning Biden and his thugs, because I don't know if he knows he's alive. And it's a shame. It's a shame what's happening to our country. This is election interference.
So we just have a minute to go. You've written three books on Donald Trump. You've won the Pulitzer Prize for your reporting, co-founded DC Report. Where do you think this is each headed? Let's be clear, this hush money trial that you think he will be convicted on, he cannot pardon himself if he becomes president because this is a state court. This is a state ruling.
Right. I don't think even this Supreme Court would uphold a federal pardon. Donald Trump, when this is over, if he does not get back to the White House, and he can do that even if he loses by 10 million votes, as I expect, in the fall, because we elect through the Electoral College, Donald Trump doesn't get back to the White House, then what lies ahead for him is financial ruin, bankruptcy, and prison, multiple long prison sentences from both state and federal criminal courts, because Donald Trump has committed serious criminal acts his whole life. And finally, after a half century of lying, cheating, stealing, plying 12-year-olds with liquor so they would gamble, doing extraordinary favors for one of the biggest cocaine traffickers in America, he's finally being held to account.
Finally, David K. Johnston, why isn't it raised that Laura Trump, who's now helping to head the RNC, is married to Eric Trump? She benefits from money going directly to the Trumps because he also has to pay up millions of dollars.
You know, 9 years ago, Amy, on your program, I said Donald Trump is a wannabe dictator. And when you're a dictator, you surround yourself with the people you trust, and the people you trust most are family. So he has now installed his daughter-in-law at the Republican National Committee, which is close to broke in terms of how much money parties should have, and has no money for down-ballot candidates, which is bad for the party.
David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist. That does it for our show. Happy birthday, Nermeen Sheikh.
Open Mic on CJSF 90.1 is where you can listen to fresh new releases from any genre, any day of the week. Visit cjsf.ca for the latest open mic schedule.
Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Radio Rewind. The following content has previously aired on CJSF. But don't worry, we'll be back next week with fresh content. CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse. Independent. Yours.